This is number 13.
13, okay.
Plus our four guns of November.
Right.
Plus umpteen archive shows like Knights of Malta, Hard Rain, One Step Beyond on Rajneesh, or a few other things. So.
Uncle Sam and the Swastika. We've got it all, folks. It's all there. Sort of a catalog of modern-day horrors that we hope you will check out, because, of course, the uninformed person is the first to go.
That's horrors.
Yes. Horrors. H-O-R-R-O-R-S.
Let's articulate. With these four-hour marathons, sometimes the lips and tongue get a little bit numb.
And so I haven't even started yet. That's the truly horrifying thing. Anyway, but as mentioned before, this is the fourth part of a four-part series we've done on Radio Free America. This is now the fourth month on this particular subject on what we call Aryan Nations. Of course, Aryan Nations is a fairly specific term and refers to a particular group, a loosely umbrellaed together group of right-wing extremists who are currently operating in the United States under that name, Aryan Nations, centered around a compound on Hayden Lake. But what we're going to be specifically talking about is not just that group, but the entire program that led up to the involvement of that group, not only the sort of Bush League folks out in the flatlands who are running around in these small militant right-wing groups, but the fact that over the years since World War II, that this kind of thinking, and then in fact many people who were charter members of this group and its antecedents, the early groups, are now, in fact, part of our government and are making national policy. And we feel this is a rather important thing to know about. And as you will see later in the broadcast, and as regular listeners are somewhat familiar with, a lot of the policy that is being made in this country and the party lines and political philosophies that are being espoused come right out of, say, for instance, John Birch Society propaganda. We find this to be rather important, and we find that there are very few people who know about these things, so this is our effort to give people a little more information so that they can live a little safer and more intelligent lives. Now, as mentioned before, we have spent a long time on this particular subject tracing these things from the early days of, well, actually, to predating World War II, to the 1930s and the foundation of right-wing Nazi-supporting groups in America, and their involvement with the America First group, which was essentially that, a group that was espousing Nazi propaganda in this country and was, in fact, even connected directly to the Nazi government in Germany and was being paid off by them to disrupt the American political situation. And, in fact, a couple of different times, members of that group and other groups were involved in plotting fascist coups in the United States. Now, I'm going to turn it over to Dave in just a moment, but one of the key things to remember here, and I guess the overall thesis of these broadcasts, is that we are not talking about, as is sometimes the impression that one gets in the media, we are not talking about merely a group of lunatics running around out in the farmlands and forests and flatlands of the United States with a penchant for collecting automatic weapons and a diehard hatred of anybody who is different. We are talking about people whose philosophies, while they may hold that philosophy, have for a long, long time played a much bigger part in formulating United States policy than has been given credit for. And when I mentioned earlier the plotted coups, among the people involved with plotting coups in the United States in the 1930s and 40s and 50s were people who were quite strongly affiliated with some of our leading military figures like General Douglas MacArthur. And we talked about that at some length in our earlier broadcast. And I'm going to let Dave get his voice in here for a moment and fill you in with a little more of the stuff that we covered already, bringing you up to the beginning of tonight's show.
Okay, now what we've really been doing on our Aryan Nations series is comparing the paramilitary right in this country, who we have subsumed under the name of Aryan Nations, and basically tracing the links between all of these supposedly separate groups. And what we've been looking at is the American paramilitary right as functioning in the same manner that the Nazi Party functioned in Germany. Now recall that in our first Aryan Nations show, number 10 in our Radio Free America series, we spoke about how the Nazi Party was, in its inception, a front for Reichswehr intelligence, for German army, for German military intelligence. The Nazi Party, initially, was a vehicle for introducing the German army into non-military civilian society in order to essentially drive the entire German political spectrum to the right. Now, specifically, we also looked at how the Nazi Party's path to power was paved by a series of assassinations performed by underground extensions of the German military. Those were known as the Freikorps or the Black Reichswehr. And long before Hitler actually assumed the chancellorship, The Freikorps and Black Reichswehr assassins had paved his way to power essentially with a road of corpses of his political enemies. Now, what we looked at with the Aryan Nations, as Nip mentioned, we looked at how this group of supposedly disaffected rednecks, recall that the far right in this country is portrayed basically as a bunch of crackers or bandits or what have you, much the same way that Hitler was portrayed initially, a street ruffian with no serious political overtones. Of course, as we looked at in our broadcasts, Adolf Hitler was an undercover informant, an undercover agent for the German army. We've looked at how the far right in this country participated, they plotted a series of military coups, and finally, one of those coups succeeded, namely the assassination of President Kennedy. We took a look at how the Aryan Nations and the Cuban Freikorps, basically an underground extension of the military, was put together in order to effect not only the Bay of Pigs, but also Operation 40, which was, for all intents and purposes, as a former CIA agent described it, a paramilitary operation, a covert CIA covert operation run in the United States. Now, out of this Cuban Freikorps, as we put it, which in turn had grown out of the China Lobby, which was a group of generals and military people, which in turn grew out of the MacArthur staff, and again, trying to go over this much material this quickly, it sounds sort of glib or maybe a little smug. If people would like to fill themselves in on more detail, we refer them to the 12 hours, roughly, of previous Aryan Nations broadcasts, because therein lies the detail and the meat. All we can do is sum it up. But anyway, we looked at how the China Lobby and the MacArthur Group gave impetus to this Cuban Freikorps, as it were, this underground extension of the military and the national security establishment put together to deal with Castro's Cuba in one capacity or another. We looked at how this group participated in the overthrow of the government, namely the assassination of the duly elected representative of the people, John Kennedy. And we then looked at how the elements of the Aryan Nations from this Cuban Freikorps participated at, or were adjacent to other political assassinations such as Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy. Now, the aspect of the broadcast that we're going to take up this evening is specifically the Ku Klux Klan's role in the American paramilitary right. Basically, we're going to take a look at the Ku Klux Klan, and specifically, we're going to get quite a ways away from Nathan Bedford Forrest and the old Knight Riders of the 19th century. What we're looking at is the new Klan, that Klan which has been formed into part of the Aryan Nations, and which, in effect, is now functioning as an underground extension, as we've said before, of the military or the intelligence services. And specifically, we're going to take a look at the Ku Klux Klan, as you could say, as an extension of the government. And then in the end of the broadcast, we're going to take a look at the government as an extension of the Ku Klux Klan. And if that seems smug, stick around.
Indeed. All right. The first segment we're going to start with, and bear in mind also that some of you who have been listening regularly will actually, not only to One Step Beyond, but to the previous Radio Free Americas, there is a little bit of overlap in the interests of making this as uniform and all encompassing a broadcast as possible. So if you hear a familiar story or a familiar part of an article or something like that, do not despair. You are not going to be listening to the entire same broadcast all over. We have just found in cases it was necessary to refresh people's memory, or in fact for people who hadn't heard it before, to give people that original information so they could understand something coming right after that. Anyway, just to give you a little bit of a warning, the first section we're going to read is from a book called Power on the Right by William W. Turner. William W. Turner, a former FBI man who also ran for Congress, and a fairly well-known researcher who has been involved in all kinds of things in the field of political research. The book was copyrighted 1971 by Ramparts Press. Power on the Right, William W. Turner. I'm going to read some short segments around here from here about a man by the name of Dennis Mower, M-O-W-E-R. Turner writes as follows. The baby-faced, impeccably groomed Mower exemplifies the cross-pollination and strange alliances, some quite fleeting, that abound on the paramilitary right. Mower is, first of all, a minister in the Church of Jesus Christ Christian, whose reigning dignitary is the Reverend Wesley A. Swift of Lancaster. 3 decades ago, Swift was part of Gerald L. K. Smith's Christian Nationalist Crusade and a rifle team instructor for a KKK group. He founded his church on the premise that members of the white race are the lost children of Israel. A spellbinding Bible thumper, Swift has put together a string of parishes in California and a small station radio network reaching an estimated 1 million listeners. Okay, now, just parenthetically before I go into the next section, this is, again, 1971, Turner is writing, and he's talking about 1 million listeners for Wesley Swift. The SWIFT complex includes the Militant Christian Defense League, or CDL, self-described in its publication Christian Defense News as, quote, white Christians, united in opposition to, among other groups, CORE, that's the Congress on Racial Equality, the NAACP, the Urban League, the American Jewish Congress, B'nai B'rith, and the Anti-Defamation League. Okay, skipping down. One of the driving forces in the CDL, again the Christian Defense League, in its early days was retired Lieutenant Colonel William P. for Potter Gale, who had trained guerrilla bands in the Philippines during World War II. In the late 1950s, Gale formed the small paramilitary California Rangers, which the California Attorney General's office alleged was, quote, designed as a secret underground guerrilla force linked with other non-military organizations by a common ideology and leadership, unquote. Gale's strategy was to try to recruit members through veterans organizations, but it backfired in 1963 when the Long Beach Press-Telegram exposed his efforts to convert the American Legion post in Signal Hill into a ranger front, and one of his rangers was arrested for selling a machine gun and Sten gun to undercover agents. In 1963, when a wealthy Los Angeles benefactor put money into the CDL, Gale tried his hand at improving its fortunes, at the same time professing, quote, the ministry of William P. Gale from the pulpits of Swift's churches. The CDL's activities stepped up under Gale's leadership. According to an infiltrator who later supplied surreptitiously made tape recordings to radio station KLAC in Los Angeles, quote, I was the security agent for the CDL national director. I guarded the security building and the files therein, the files which extended through most every state in the Union. Members of the Klan, members of all other extremist groups who joined in to help make Christian Defense League the central group, the reporting group for all of these organizations. The very sister and co-worker in this of the CDL on the West Coast is the National States Rights Party, unquote. Remember that name, it will come up a lot more, NSRP, National States Rights Party. On the night of June 10, 1964, he related, Swift and his associates met in Reseda, with George Lincoln Rockwell to discuss, quote, a merger for the purpose of exchanging and compiling intelligence information to make and keep an up-to-date roster of agents, double agents, and other informers, unquote, and to devise a command order. California Deputy Attorney General Thomas McDonald has advised that there has been a, quote, real coalescence between the Swift complex, the NSRP, and Klan-like groups in Southern California. Okay, some key points to point out here. First of all, Maurer, whose name will come up again, Maurer's affiliations with Reverend Wesley Swift, and Swift, of course, being the biggie in the Church of Jesus Christ Christian, but also his earlier affiliations with Gerald L. K. Smith, which we talked about going clear back into the 30s, and also his involvement with the KKK. Now, you will notice the coalescence of these groups.
It's also worth noting, too, that Gerald L.K. Smith was one of the people, one of the group of MacArthur staffers and supporters who were pushing for not first military coups, and then once that subsided, for General Douglas MacArthur as president. And it's worth noting because Swift actually nominated Douglas MacArthur for L.K. Smith's organization, and William Gale is a MacArthur staffer, and interestingly for our purposes, who trained guerrilla bands in the Philippines. And again, the MacArthur staff is the key thing that we've been looking at here. But Swift actually nominated MacArthur for president on behalf of L.K. Smith. And it's worth noting because in the past we've highlighted the Nazi elements, and we're going to take a look at many of the same people from a Ku Klux Klan perspective. But I think it's worth noting here that these same people have been, again, by way of recalling the MacArthur links that we've covered in our first 12 hours or so.
Indeed. So, again, note that the important presence in the Christian Defense League of William Potter Gale. Potter Gale, as Dave mentioned, a key functionary under MacArthur and connected to all the other MacArthur functionaries that we talked about in the first three parts of the broadcast, some of whose names will come back up again. And as Dave mentioned, also connected through them into Gerald L.K. Smith and other people who are actually involved in plotting a fascist takeover of this country. Also notice the connection between the CDL and the National States Rights Party, a group that's very tightly affiliated with the Klan, and also that's been involved in, among other things, the assassination of Martin Luther King that we've talked about and we will talk about some more. And last but not least, of course, George Lincoln Rockwell, as Dave mentioned, the Nazi presence, George Lincoln Rockwell, of course, the head of the American Nazi Party, His phone number was in Oswald's wallet, and George Lincoln Rockwell himself also was another assassination victim, although perhaps not as mourned as some of the other assassination victims that we've talked about here. So again, the coming together of these groups, the Wesley Swift group, the National States Rights Party, and various other right-wing organizations.
That group that Nip just read you from Power on the Right, might be termed the nascent Aryan Nations. In other words, it appears that there, this coalescing of these groups, which we have now seen under the Aryan Nations, was obviously well underway. And we're going to trace a lot of those elements through the years for you. Back to Dennis Mauer and some of his activities. And again, Dennis Mauer, very close to the Ku Klux Klan. And remember this because he's very close to some very powerful people as well. Again, the Klan have the reputation for being a bunch of crackers or a bunch of rednecks, a bunch of street bandits, so to speak. And we're going to show you the very lofty corridors of power that they tread upon occasion. More information about Dennis Mauer from a book that we read from in our last program called Legacy of Doubt. That was authored by Peter Noyes, N-O-Y-E-S, published in softcover by Pinnacle Books and copyrighted 1973. Of Dennis Mauer, Noyes writes as follows. Violence and intrigue had been a way of life for Dennis Mauer since he was a teenager. In 1965, at the age of 19, he was implicated in a plot to smear Thomas Kuchel, K-U-C-H-E-L, at that time a Republican United States Senator from California, as a homosexual. According to a Los Angeles County grand jury transcript, Mauer tried to confront Kuchel in his office at the United States Courthouse in Los Angeles with an affidavit linking the liberal senator to Walter Jenkins, the aide to President Johnson who resigned in disgrace after his homosexual activities became public knowledge. At the time of the incident, Mauer represented himself as the president of the Southern California Freedoms Council. Los Angeles County District Attorney Evel Younger, who later became the Attorney General of California, decided to prosecute those involved in the Kuchel smear, but Mauer was granted immunity from prosecution in return for his testimony before the grand jury. The others implicated in the plot, one of whom was a Los Angeles policeman, were found guilty of criminal libel, perhaps the least enforced statute in the criminal and the California Penal Code. Worth noting here that Evel Younger, the person who granted Dennis Mauer immunity from prosecution, much the way many of the witnesses in the Order trial, a spinoff of the Aryan Nations, have been granted immunity from prosecution. The person who granted this immunity to Dennis Mauer and thereby protected him was Evel Younger, at that time L.A. District Attorney, and in our for our purposes here, perhaps most notably, the man who prosecuted successfully Saran Saran as the lone nut assassin of Robert Kennedy. In Radio Free America number 9, we punched some rather massive holes in that thesis. Saran Saran, in all probability, was a mind-control dupe. That is to say, his mind was controlled in such a way as to make him think he committed an assassination, which it appears... Well, which he obviously did not commit. It appears that the shooting, in all probability, was done by a man named Thane Caesar, who we'll talk about briefly before. Worth noting here, though, that the L.A. District Attorney, Evel Younger, later Attorney General of California, lets Dennis Mauer off the hook here, so to speak, and that one of the people that Dennis Mauer was conspiring with against a liberal Republican in California was a Los Angeles policeman, the LAPD also being front and center in the assassination of Robert Kennedy.
And, of course, the Los Angeles Police Department having been recently in the news about putting together data banks on behalf of other right-wing sources, and we will talk about that later in the broadcast. But, again, a very common thread, and, of course, in this book, Power on the Right by William Turner, he devotes an entire chapter to the involvement of various police forces, of which Los Angeles Police Force is among the worst offenders, with paramilitary right-wing organizations. One other comment just needs to be made, again, for new listeners. The statement that Sirhan Sirhan was in all likelihood a mind-controlled assassination dupe may sound a little bit glib, as Dave sometimes puts it, or a little bit smug. Again, we would hasten to advise that you go back and you check either the earlier broadcasts of this series or our Guns of November series on the assassination of President John F. Kennedy, in which Robert Kennedy's assassination is talked about, and bear in mind also that, among other things, the L.A. County Coroner's report was in direct contradiction of the verdict as it later came down of Sirhan being the assassin. So,
again, now the reason why we proceed so slowly and pedantically with these broadcasts is so that we can speed things up a little bit in One Step Beyond and make the kinds of equations which, you know, again, may seem a little smug to some people, but they're rooted in this documentation, and that's why we take the time to sort of pour through this in the way that we do, because we do have a lot of ground to cover, and it saves us time.
Okay, reading some more from Power on the Right. A character being discussed here by the name of Patrick J. Frawley, Jr. Frawley, F-R-A-W-L-E-Y, a rather familiar figure even to this day because of his early and strenuous backing of Ronald Reagan. And Turner writes, more recently, and again more recently as of 1971, Frawley exercised veto power over a nominee for United States Attorney in Los Angeles. In 1969, the Nixon administration submitted the name of Samuel Potter III, a loyal Republican, to the Senate for confirmation. The customary FBI background check turned up no derogatory information. But a second FBI check was ordered, and it provided a pretext for withdrawing the nomination. Frawley and his allies had objected to Potter in the strongest possible terms. The reason for the objection lay in the deep antipathy of the ultra-right wing of the party in California to former Senator Thomas H. Kuchel, as previously mentioned by Dave, a moderate. Potter's sin was that he had supported Kuchel in the 1968 primary, which he lost to the darling of the ultras, Max Rafferty. Kuchel had been under relentless attack from the ultras, he means, of course, ultra-rights, and in 1963 had replied from the floor of the Senate with a searing speech that opened, quote, Mr. President, we face the fright peddlers. In 1965, the feud took a sordid turn when the senator discovered an affidavit circulating among members of Congress and newsmen that falsely accused him of being involved in a homosexual incident. A Los Angeles grand jury eventually indicted four men for criminal libel, two former policemen, Francis A. Capel of the ultra-rightist Herald of Freedom, that's a newspaper, and Schick public relations man John F. Fergus. Dennis Maurer of the paramilitary Southern California Freedom Councils was implicated but was not prosecuted in return for his testimony. All pleaded no contest. Under oath, Frawley disclaimed any knowledge of the character assassination plot, explaining that Fergus had been hired merely, quote, to make speeches on free enterprise and against communism at local groups, unquote. Bear in mind, too, that that reference to Fergus, a Schick public relations man, that Patrick Frawley was the owner of Schick, and that he, in fact, was the employer of Fergus, in any sense that Fergus was employed, he certainly was the employer. And as mentioned before, Patrick Frawley, not only a prime mover in the ultra-right wing milieu in Orange County in Southern California, a big backer of the John Birch Society and related groups down there, and also, of course, a big backer of Ronald Reagan, who is now our president. And this will become more significant as the show goes on.
It's also worth noting that Patrick Frawley is one of the prime movers in an organization called the American Security Council, which acts in a manner very much like Western goals. It sort of keeps files on private American citizens for the purposes of the defense industry and the military and right-wing politicos in general. And that organization, the American Security Council, was very closely affiliated with something called the Information Council of the Americas, a man named Ed Butler, and those organizations in turn crop up prominently in the background of the assassinations of both Kennedys and related events. So recall that in this particular incident in which powerful people, people right behind Ronald Reagan like William Frawley, were trying to remove a liberal Republican senator, we see people like the venal Klansman, Minuteman, and American Nazi Dennis Maurer not only being used for these ends, but also receiving, at least apparently, protection from a prosecution when the warm and brown hits the fan, so to speak. Ebel Younger basically makes Dennis Maurer a witness. Patrick Frawley appears to be one of the people pulling his strings. More information about this man, Frank Capel, here in just a second. Reading now from an unpublished manuscript by Peter Dale Scott. He is a professor at the University of California at Berkeley, and this essay, this manuscript, is called Government Documents and the John F. Kennedy Assassination. And reading about Frank Capel, he was described by a fellow right-winger in the following terms. Capel, C-A-P-E-L-L, by the way. A private expert on communism and communistic information who, I understand, has the cooperation of many former intelligence officers of the Army and former members of the FBI. So the man working with Dennis Maurer is basically an Army intelligence operative. And bear in mind that Capel also, in addition to Maurer, is moving in a de facto fashion here in the same direction as Frawley and Ebel Younger. Continuing here with Peter Dale Scott's essay. Capel was also in close touch with both General Charles Willoughby, MacArthur's former G2, and Dennis Maurer, a leader of the California Minuteman. Now, of course, Charles Willoughby is a person we've looked at before. His real name is Charles Weidenbach, and he's a German, and specifically a doctrinaire fascist whose idol was Francisco Franco, and as indicated here, he was the highest-ranking military intelligence officer in the Pacific during World War II, and a prime mover with regard to the John Birch Society and the paramilitary right in general. So this is the kind of company that Dennis Maurer is keeping. People like Willoughby, people like Capel, also connected with military intelligence, people like Patrick Frawley, people like Ebel Younger, an impressive group of people. Continuing with Peter Dale Scott's essay. The Minutemen Maurer and Hall were also allegedly close to the Ku Klux Klan and the politically allied National States Rights Party, as well as to right-wing Cubans. This may help explain why the son of Mario Garcia Colli, K-O-H-L-Y, the chosen political leader of the MRR Artime, that's an anti-Castro Cuban group, and MDC Laureano Batista, another anti-Castro Cuban group, and a close friend of Fiorini's Pedro Diaz Lanz, should serve as guerrilla leader for a group of Minutemen near Reading, Pennsylvania, with American Nazi and NSRP KKK members. Basically, that passage there simply merges Maurer and Hall, Lauren Eugene Hall, a person we looked at last time, into what, again, what we referred to as the Cuban Freikorps, this paramilitary underground extension of the military. And again, Maurer is a Klansman and a person that enjoys quite a bit of protection, and in particular, he's a person who's close to another member of the Aryan Nations, a guy named Keith Gilbert.
And I was just curious, is the Fiorini that Scott is referring to there the very self-same Frank Sturgis?
The very same, right. Frank, there's so many names I didn't want to destroy the train of thought. I'm glad you brought that up, though, because Frank Fiorini is, that's the former name for Frank Sturgis. I was about to call him E. Howard Hunt, but Frank Sturgis, who not only a Watergate burglar, but a man who we'd like to say has more connections than a switchboard, one of those connections being the assassination of President Kennedy.
That's right. Now, we're talking about Keith Gilbert and still Dennis Maurer.
Recall that Keith Gilbert, again, filling in briefly from last program, Keith Gilbert is part of the Aryan Nations group, was very closely affiliated with the Hayden Lake compound of Richard Butler until he split with Butler and established his own closely related compound a few miles down the road. That's the Keith Gilbert we're talking about.
Now, earlier in the broadcast, we talked about the fact that, or we mentioned in passing, that a lot of these people keep cropping up time after time in the various assassinations, not only the assassination of John F. Kennedy, which we've detailed in some depth, but because of the Hunt family involvement, will probably come up again tonight at some point, but also the assassinations of Martin Luther King and Robert F. Kennedy, especially right now because we're talking about the Southern California Klan and Nazi milieu. And, of course, here you will see further connections coming up in just a moment to that self-same assassination, that of Robert F. Kennedy. Again, reading from Legacy of Doubt by Peter Noyes. According to California intelligence agents who infiltrated meetings of the Minutemen, presided over by Dennis Maurer in the early 1960s, the rhetoric more often than not dealt with assassinating, quote, the three Ks, John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, and Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., all of whom met violent deaths. But was it just that, mere rhetoric? The public record shows it was not. In February of 1965, Keith Gilbert, a ranking member of the Minutemen and one of Maurer's closest associates, was accused by the Los Angeles police of masterminding a plot to kill Dr. King. Police charged that Gilbert planned to assassinate King by blowing up the Hollywood Palladium when the civil rights leader spoke there. As proof, they offered 1,400 pounds of dynamite, which had been seized in a raid on Gilbert's apartment. While free on bond and waiting trial, Gilbert fled to Canada. At first, he had no visible means of support, but after a few weeks, he began receiving checks for fairly substantial amounts from an unknown benefactor in the United States. Eventually, Gilbert was extradited to the United States by Canadian authorities and returned to Los Angeles, where he was found guilty of possessing explosives and was sentenced to a term of 1 to 10 years in prison. While confined in San Quentin, the would-be assassin of Dr. King was interviewed on a number of occasions by intelligence officers from various law enforcement agencies. Gilbert repeatedly indicated he had, quote, something important to discuss, but once the interviews began, he was evasive, usually moaning about how unpleasant it was to be in San Quentin. Even though Gilbert was behind prison bars, he continued to receive checks for fairly substantial amounts from, quote, benefactors on the outside. One investigator referred to the checks as hush money. Gilbert, however, insisted the checks were sent by persons who owed him considerable amounts of money. It was determined that some of the checks came from the Reverend Dennis Maurer, who was not known to dabble in charity or lost causes. Ironically, Gilbert's name was mentioned prominently during the investigation into the assassination of Senator Robert Kennedy in Los Angeles. Details of that investigation will be discussed in a subsequent chapter.
So Keith Gilbert, again, a protege and associate of Dennis Maurer, plotted against the life of Martin Luther King, was jailed for that, had protection in prison, and now we're going to look at some connections between him and the assassination of Robert Kennedy. Again, Keith Gilbert, a key Aryan Nations person.
And one other thing to mention, too, again, for those of you who are listening for fairly the first time or an early time, is that these are not, of course, the only connections between this, as we call it, paramilitary right-wing milieu and the assassinations of Robert F. Kennedy, John F. Kennedy, and Martin Luther King. We have gone over those in depth, and in fact, the actual assassinations themselves are directly traceable. Involvement in these assassinations is directly traceable to these right-wing groups. We are using these particular instances of these connections merely to highlight mostly the interaction and the inner workings of these groups for the purpose of this show.
And again, some of the equations that we make may seem a little facile under the circumstances, but it's the very length and depth of the material that we've presented before upon which those kinds of equations rest. And again, if people are skeptical or if it seems a little overly cute, we have the 12 hours for you to delve into, and that's basically what we encourage would-be critics to do. At any rate, another thing before we proceed here with the connections of Keith Gilbert to the assassination of Robert Kennedy, it's worth noting that the names of the organizations in this paramilitary milieu that we've been examining are really less important than the actions of the people and the names of the people. We see organizations coming and going and shifting boundaries and so forth, but we see the same people in these organizations associating with one another and doing the same kinds of activities, because whether it's NSRP, American Nazi, Klan, Minutemen, we see, again, same people, same actions, different names of our organizations, suggesting that perhaps the names of the organizations are secondary here, and that the amalgam of all of these people into one large group is the dominant consideration. Again, maintain the Maurer-Keith-Gilbert relationship in your mind. And we're going to talk about something that we read about at the end of our last broadcast, namely the relationship between Keith Gilbert and a person who figures in the investigation of the Robert Kennedy assassination. Continuing with Legacy of Doubt by Peter Noyes. One of those handcuffed by police shortly after Robert Kennedy was shot was a young student from Los Angeles City College, Michael Wayne, who vaguely resembled Saran Saran. In checking out the name of Michael Wayne at police headquarters, investigators found it cross-indexed to Keith Gilbert. At the time, Gilbert had been implicated in the plot to kill Dr. Martin Luther King. Police had found the calling card of a Michael Wayne in the garage of the Minuteman's Glendale residence. After several hundred man-hours of investigation, the police finally satisfied themselves that the Michael Wayne connected with Keith Gilbert was someone entirely different from the youth taken into custody at the Ambassador Hotel. Well, Michael Wayne, according to this information, was a different person than the person connected to Keith Gilbert. But again, the Los Angeles Police Department not only was not the best investigator of this particular crime, but the LAPD specifically covered up the pertinent facts in the Robert Kennedy assassination. We covered that in our program, our Radio Free America, number 9. And it's going to read you some information which is going to detail how Michael Wayne figures into the assassination of Robert Kennedy. It's worth noting that Michael Wayne had a close physical resemblance to Saran Saran. He was apparently, at least according to LAPD files, connected to, or someone named Michael Wayne was connected to Keith Gilbert, the American Nazi, and associate of Dennis Maurer, who in turn was at least on decent terms with Elville Younger, the man who prosecuted Saran. But it's worth noting that Michael Wayne was dogging Robert Kennedy and other Democratic primary candidates around in the L.A. area. He was at the Ambassador Hotel the night Robert Kennedy was shot and was in the pantry. And his presence there as a double, virtually, of Saran Saran, the resemblance was close, if not identical, cropped up very, very prominently in the insanity defense, or the insanity verdict that was rendered on Saran Saran.
Okay, I'm going to read a short segment to you here from a book called RFK Must Die, A History of the Robert Kennedy Assassination and Its Aftermath by Robert Blair Kaiser, 1970, published by Grow Press in New York. Just a short segment, actually, and you don't have to like the rest of Mr. Kaiser's book, which I don't, just to use this particular segment here. They're talking now about Dr. Diamond. Dr. Diamond was a court-ordered psychiatrist. To explain this behavior, Dr. Diamond had posited his theory. The theory being that Sirhan Sirhan had fired the shot that killed Robert F. Kennedy in a sort of post-hypnotic spasm brought on by his own self-hypno-programming. That's the theory that we're talking about here. To explain this behavior, Dr. Diamond had posited his theory. Sirhan, already hypnosis-prone from his experiments with the occult, went into a spontaneous trance at the ambassador. Triggered by the drinks he had had and the bright lights and the mirrors in the lobby, he went out to his car, got his gun, and programmed by his instructions to himself in the notebook, but with no knowledge then that Kennedy would move through the pantry, just happened to be there when Kennedy appeared. It was a million-to-one shot. Dr. Diamond didn't believe Jesus Perez, the busboy witness who reported that Sirhan asked him whether Kennedy was coming through the pantry. And neither did I. That's Kaiser speaking. I think he confused Sirhan with another young man in the pantry named Michael Wayne, who looked like Sirhan. Wayne did ask several people in the pantry, including Perez, which way Kennedy was coming. Okay, so a couple of things to look at, besides the rather interesting theory that Dr. Diamond has come up with to explain how Sirhan Sirhan hypno-programmed himself into shooting Robert F. Kennedy. Mind you, we do not discount the possibility that Sirhan Sirhan was in fact hypno-programmed. As a matter of fact, those of you who listen to the other broadcasts realize that the evidence seems to point in that direction. But this particular theory is a little bit leaky. But, more importantly, the involvement of Michael Wayne.
I'm just going to say that the full account of Dr. Diamond's diagnosis of Sirhan is in our Radio Free America number 6. Okay, so I believe it's number 6, maybe it's number 5. I'm pretty sure it's number 6, and we recapped that a little bit in our Robert Kennedy show, too. So our other Radio Free America shows, numbers 6 and 9, carry the details about Dr. Diamond's machinations here.
Now, again, it's interesting to note this, and that Dr. Diamond's theory also hangs on Sirhan being hypnosis-prone from his experiments with the occult, because a group of right-wingers, including Sam Yorty, who was then mayor of Los Angeles, went into press right after the Robert F. Kennedy assassination with a whole bunch of really wild accusations linking Sirhan with communists and Madame Blavatsky and the Theosophists and all kinds of weird stuff, basically trying to call him a commie occult killer. Now, it's interesting that Diamond should drag that into the hypnosis, the self-hypnosis theory. But more importantly, we see that this, if it is a coincidence, this coincidental showing up of Michael Wayne, the Sirhan Sirhan lookalike, who also shares a name, although the police claim nothing else, with a man affiliated with Keith Gilbert. Michael Wayne shows up asking in the pantry, and obviously mistaken by at least one person, the busboy, for Sirhan, asking if Kennedy is coming through. This in and of itself, if he had passed himself off by accident or on purpose as Sirhan Sirhan, asking about Kennedy, would have written off any possibility of a spur-of-the-moment assassination defense, that he hadn't planned to do it, it just happened, but that, in fact, then it would help to convict Sirhan Sirhan of a premeditated murder. A spur-of-the-moment crazy act can get you into a mental institution. A premeditated murder, in many cases, and especially in California, I believe at that time, can wind you up on death row. And once you finish your sojourn there, which Sirhan Sirhan did not go to, then you don't talk to anybody ever again about what might actually have happened. So it's interesting to note the possibility that if, and it's an if this Michael Wayne is the same Michael Wayne, that in fact the whole thing was set up to establish some sort of premeditation on the part of Sirhan Sirhan, just as many people feel was done with Lee Harvey Oswald at the shooting range, et cetera, et cetera.
Actually, the way in which it was used, the Michael Wayne killing, was Diamond used it to and the people in the investigation used it to prove that that Sirhan was nuts. In other words, how that actually, it's confusing writing. What they actually did was Wayne was in the pantry, and the prosecution was attempting to prove that, in their attempt to prove that Sirhan had premeditated, were citing the fact that he had asked where Kennedy was coming as evidence of that. And Diamond's thesis was that Sirhan went into a spontaneous hypnotic trance there and just happened to pull the trigger. And then in the presence of Wayne, because it's very confusing, I had to read it a couple of times myself, and in fact, there are some contradictory statements earlier in Kaiser's book, but the way Diamond used Wayne and the way he figures in this was to blow off the whole idea of Sirhan being a conscious assassin, and to make him out literally to be a nut, a mental case here. And because if Michael Wayne could if Saran could be proved to have asked where Kennedy was coming from, obviously he was laying in wait for him. But the presence of Michael Wayne enabled people to dismiss any notion that Saran was acting in a conscious political sense and simply made it a psychiatric case. It is a little confusing from the context there. That's actually, Michael Wayne, his presence there was critical to Diamond's spontaneous hypnotic trance thesis. And that's really the significance of Wayne here. It's a complicated case, but again, people might be inclined to dismiss this as just a trivial incident, but the fact of the matter is that in a political assassination of this type, Robert Kennedy, John Kennedy, or so forth, when major political forces are being rearranged, the finest details are prearranged, and all of the details are worked out ahead of time and contingencies worked out, and specifically the details are worked out in such a way as to appear like happenstance. But in a major political assassination, nothing is left to chance, and little details like that which figure in the official version are worth noting here. And again, Keith Gilbert, a primary functionary of the Aryan Nations, is one of the people we want to be looking at in connection with the Robert Kennedy assassination in the future as we observe the facts that come to light. Now, a couple of things about the Robert Kennedy assassination, connections to neo-Nazis and the Aryan Nations neo-Nazi network that we've talked about. We looked in our past broadcast, actually number 12, at Lockheed Burbank facility. Specifically, we took a look at the presence there of Thane Eugene Caesar, the security guard at the Ambassador Hotel, who in all probability pulled the trigger on Robert Kennedy and was the real assassin. Now, Thane Eugene Caesar was closely affiliated with American Nazis. He worked, interestingly enough, as a security guard in the secret U-2 section of Lockheed's Burbank facility. And U-2, of course, very closely affiliated with CIA. Two of the main names that we've looked at in the past connection with U-2 are Edwin Wilson, who was in charge of its security, the plane went down, and Lee Harvey Oswald, the person upon whom that blame was placed. Okay, so Thane Eugene Caesar, CIA, U-2, and Burbank all hook up in the Robert Kennedy assassination, and it's worth noting that at the same time as Thane Caesar was working there, Richard Butler, the steward of the Aryan Nations Hayden Lake compound, was also working as an engineer at Lockheed Burbank. And also, another thing that we looked at was the fact that Richard Nixon, who benefited prominently from the Robert Kennedy assassination, and whose friends were whose close friends and political allies were very closely affiliated, well, let me work this out. Basically, Saran was brought into the country. His family's entry into the United States was sponsored by some close personal friends of Richard Nixon's and political allies. Of course, Robert Kennedy's assassination removed Robert Kennedy from Richard Nixon's path. It's worth noting that the security coordinator for Richard Nixon's campaign in 1968 was a man named James Golden, who was on leave from Lockheed, where he was director of security, Thane Caesar being a security guard at Lockheed Burbank, where Richard Butler is an engineer. Someone was showing us some notes here through the window, so got a little confused on that, but we'll proceed from that point. It's a little confusing, but Lockheed Burbank, Richard Butler, Thane Caesar, James Golden, security coordinator from Lockheed, runs Richard Nixon's campaign in 1968. Friends of Richard Nixon sponsor the entry of the Saran family. The Kennedy assassination removes Robert Kennedy from Nixon's path, much as the John Kennedy assassination removed John Kennedy. Okay?